This podcast is sponsored by FHE Health and their Shatterproof program for first responders.
What makes Shatterproof a very unique program is it's one of the only programs in the country that first responders can go to that is 100% all first responders. Everybody's in pretty bad shape when they get here. And then 30 days later, when you can see the transformation and the difference in people when they've had 30 days of counseling, working with therapists, working with a psychiatrist, getting the neuro treatment, doing the breath therapy that's done here, the transformation that happens with the clients is really humbling to be able to work around and see, because people are getting better here. And it just shows that there's a need for the first responder community to deal with behavioral health issues and take them seriously and offer treatment to people that may need help out there. They should be afforded the ability to come get help when they need help. It has gotten better, but we still have a long way to go.
Have you ever been talking to one of your friends or somebody and the topic of meditation and mindfulness comes up and they give you the kind of this weird look like you're crazy, that only hippies and people that with their legs crossed and flowing robes do meditation? I have. But there is a reason why professional sports teams, law enforcement, firefighters, even elite military units have now begun to employ meditation and mindfulness. Just ask my next guest, John McCaskill. Now, John is a retired Navy SEAL commander turned mindfulness and meditation teacher. He is a U.S. Naval Academy graduate and holds a master's degree in operations research from the Naval Postgraduate School. Now, John has been on the show. He is an amazing guy who served his country well, and he goes and he teaches law enforcement and organizations how to become more mindful, which is basically living in the moment. John and I have had a great conversation during this show, and you're going to love it. A lot of good takeaways. John McCaskill, next on the CJ Evolution Podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I'm so excited to have this guy back on the show. He's John McCaskill, retired Navy SEAL commander turned leadership and mindfulness coach. Sir, welcome back.
Hey, man, it's great to be back. I know we had this scheduled for, a month and a half ago, something like that, and had to reschedule, and I appreciate your grace and your flexibility.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's great to be back on the show, man. I enjoyed it last time, and I know I'm going to enjoy it this time.
Absolutely, my friend. And you were in the Navy for 24 years.
Yeah.
All with the teams?
No, I was an enlisted guy first, enlisted out of high school, tried to get in the Naval Academy out of high school, got turned down. So I was like bound and determined I was going to serve in the Navy and specifically in the SEAL teams. So I enlisted in the Navy, became a parachute rigger, worked on ejection seats. A technical term for that parachute rigger in the Navy is air crew survival equipment, man. So I'm not like the parachute rigger in the Army.
It's a I was going to say, you're like the guy packing the chutes and stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm packing the chutes on the ejection seats on these jets.
That's cool.
And packing like everything else that goes into the ejection seat. So did that for just shy of a year, and then got picked up from the enlisted ranks to go to the Naval Academy, and then graduated in May of 2001. And then we all know what happened to the world in September of that same year, and was at BUDS, basic underwater demolition SEAL training, on 9/11. So that was, the rest of my time was in the SEAL teams from there, and SEAL training and SEAL teams, and then retired in August of 2020.
So you went in because you went to the academy. So you went in, or you entered the teams or went to BUDS and all that stuff as an officer.
I did. Yeah, sure did.
And for those people who don't know, so when you're in BUDS, I mean, there's no rank, correct? I mean, there is.
Excuse me. there is rank, and you run around. So I don't know if you can see the helmets behind me. So the green helmet is first phase. Let's see, blue helmet and red helmet, that's second and third phase. And that line that comes down the center of the helmet, that shows that you're an officer.
Oh.
And then when you don't have helmets on, you still wear your rank on your uniform, but it's not like showing very it's not super obvious, but you're still, as an officer, you're a leader of some, in some capacity within the BUDS class. You're a boat crew leader, you're the class leader, you're an administrative leader. You, there's all the different roles that are assigned out to the officers. Yeah.
Absolutely. I just remember the Army and some of the schools I went through, there was no rank, and they're like, we don't care if you're a lieutenant, you know, not that I was a lieutenant, but they just kind of, so every service is different, obviously. Yeah. So when you got, this fascinates me about you, brother. I mean, so you could have easily, and maybe you did, you got out of the military, got out of the Navy. Thank you for your service, if I didn't say so.
Thanks, brother. Back at you.
How did you make this transition into, because when I tell people about John McCaskill, I'm like, hey, guy's great, man. You got to have him on your show. You know, he's a commander in the SEAL teams, and he's a mindfulness coach now. He's which is cool.
Yeah.
Which is awesome, because I love that. I love that. I love, you know, meditation, all that stuff, yoga.
It's good, man. And that's why I got into it, but I didn't know it was good for the longest time. Yeah. I was introduced to it about 10 years after an event, specifically an Operation Red Wings, that I'm sure many of your audience is familiar with. I was connected to that operation, and I say the term connected because I was not on that operation, but I was in the Joint Operations Center on the radios, on the computers, on the phones. And when that operation went sideways, in my mind, I was in the wrong place. I wanted to be on the battlefield with my brothers who were fighting. And that caused me a lot of anxiety and guilt, moral injury. And I carried that with me, and I addressed it by kind of secretly drinking and abusing prescription medication. And it got to a point where I was in a very dark spot. And I went and visited a counselor, and he recommended mindfulness and meditation to me. And to keep a long story short, I refused it at first. I was like, man, this is a bunch of BS.
Yeah.
And then he convinced me to try it out. And I tried it. And the first time I was like, man, still it's a bunch of BS, because I couldn't sit still for longer than like 15 seconds at a time.
Sure.
So he tried again, and eventually I got into it. Got past the initial hurdles that I had, the reticence that I had to it, and it changed my life. It changed my life for the better, and then quite literally saved my life. So when I was starting to look at the proverbial exit ramp of the military and looking to transition to civilian life, I was looking at a lot of different jobs. I was looking at commercial real estate. I was looking at private equity, you know, a lot of the bright and shiny objects that are out there for transitioning service members. And none of them, I mean, they're all great jobs, but none of them
speak to you.
Yeah. It didn't speak to me. And kept coming back to this mindfulness and meditation stuff. And long story short, here I am, man.
That's amazing. And I know you speak to a lot of people. You're constantly on the go. What have you adopted from being in the SEAL teams into your mindfulness training, your seminars? Because I know you probably took a lot of it.
From it.
Obviously, discipline is probably a big one. But what else would you say really you brought from the teams into your work now?
Yeah. Well, the discipline, absolutely. I in my talks I refer to it as preparedness. Is the planning piece that I brought into my current jobs and in my life as a whole. I do a lot of backwards planning. If you ever talk to my wife, she'll say that I plan a little bit too much. Like, hey, I have an event here.
But that's what you're used to.
That's what I'm used to. I'm limiting or identifying this event and then going backwards, doing the plan of action and milestones to make this event a success.
Yeah.
And planning the contingencies that are
exactly
inevitably going to happen, right? So the military planning, absolutely. Grit and resilience. That's what I talk about a lot. And then the piece that I talk about that initially at the surface level doesn't sound like it should come from the military, but empathy and compassion.
I love it.
And I wrote a post about this very thing this morning on Operation Red Wings. One of my guys just before they left out on the reconnaissance mission, this guy pulls me aside. He's like, "Hey, Mac, hey, man, I'm scared." And he had never told me that he was scared about an op before, but he pulled me aside and he's like, yeah, boss, I'm scared. And there was a part of me that wanted to be like, "Hey, man, suck it up. You know, that's what we get paid for and all this other stuff." And then I realized that's not what he needed. He didn't need to hear that.
Yeah.
And that's not what I could do as a leader to make him feel better. And so I told him, "Hey, man, there's not an op that I go on that I'm not scared."
Yeah.
And that's the difference is
did that going calm out him? Did that calm
yeah,
him?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. It did. Absolutely. Unfortunately he ended up dying on that op, but I mean, so he was scared for all the right reasons.
Yeah.
But that empathy and that compassion, instead of barking at him, instead of trying to motivate him to not be scared, I was like, "Man, I totally understand. I get it." And that I think translates in every leadership role. You've got to have some level of compassion for your people, and then compassion for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are some of the big takeaways from the SEAL teams.
Absolutely. I love it. You know, empathy and compassion. I mean, I tell people, you know, I was a cop for a long time, 23 years, and I am much more empathetic now, having gone through treatment and having gone through some dark places with alcohol and depression and all that stuff. I am much more empathetic now than I ever was as a cop. I mean, I was empathetic to a degree.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's hammered out of you, you know, to suppress your feelings and emotions and grit and resilience, which is good because it keeps you alive for the next call. I mean, you got to have a kind of a balance there somewhere, in my opinion. But yeah, I'm much more empathetic now, not just for first responders and military that are suffering. It's just there's so much suffering out there. But
yeah,
compassion and empathy are huge in my book. And show a little kindness, show a little compassion.
Right,
and I loved what you did as a commander, as the boss. Because he was probably thinking, "Well, shit, if Mac's scared, you know, this is normal, you know, or no, you didn't say you were scared, but I get it."
I didn't tell him that I was scared about that particular operation, because that was the same one that I was just going to be sitting behind a desk. But I told him that I'd been scared on ops before. And I always felt that if you're not scared, if you're going on these, you know, something's wrong. You know, the people that are not scared, there's two types of people who don't get scared: psychopaths and stupid. and he wasn't either one of them. So,
but I love that. And it's so, you know, kind of pivoted a little bit into leadership, but I think that's lacking a lot now.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
You know,
for sure. Man.
Definitely in the first responder field and the law enforcement field. And I wish it would. And yeah, I wish we would get that back somehow. I'm not saying everybody out there is not doing it. I'm not trying to indict everybody who's listening. I'm just saying that I think it's more needed, especially in this world.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, coming back to that being scared piece and compassion, I talk about on stage at Buds, we do this thing called rock boardage. And that's where you row these inflatable boats past the surf. And then you come back, you turn the boats around and you row the boats back to shore. But this time you're landing them on this jetty of rocks. And this jetty of rocks is right outside the Hotel Del, right there in Coronado. It's beautiful. And you do it during the daytime and you kind of feel cool because all these tourists come out from the hotel. And then you fast forward about 12 hours and you do it again at night and there's no tourists out there and you can hear the waves crashing behind you and it's scary as hell. And I'm a perfectionist. So I told my guys, "Hey, we're waiting for the perfect wave." And I see these other boat crews take, you know, kind of crappy waves and they get tossed on the rocks and it looks like somebody dumped a laundry basket on the rocks. I mean, there's people everywhere. and then I look back and finally I see this perfect wave. I'm like, "All right, boys, we're taking this wave." And we catch this perfect wave perfectly and we land perfectly on the rocks.
That's awesome.
And like, I'm super excited, right? No, it wasn't good, man. I hear from behind the rocks, "Mr. McCaskill, where the hell have you and your boat crew been?" And
you're waited too long.
Yeah, I'd waited too long and I was all proud. I was like, "Well, we were waiting for the perfect wave." And man, the instructors had a freaking field day with me after that. They're like, oh, you think war is going to be perfect? You think the battlefield is going to be perfect?
Perfect conditions.
But of course, it's not, right?
Yeah.
And so I paid the price for that. They punished me. But who was right beside me getting punished were my boys, my men from my boat crew. They were getting punished for my fear of the rocks, fear of being hurt, but more importantly, my fear of imperfection. I wanted it to be perfect. Yeah. And because I wanted it to be perfect, I failed and they failed. So coming back to one of your questions, your question before, what did I bring from the SEAL teams is, one, we're going to be scared and we have to do things anyway. And then two is that you can't wait until things are perfect. You have to do things when things are imperfect, because they're never going to be perfect.
Yeah. And I tell people, you know, all your growth is being uncomfortable.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, the traffic lights of life are not all going to be green at the same time, you know?
Yep.
And I think that's, you know, that's important. And I think we're getting back to mindfulness and what you do. What's your definition? If you could sum it up in maybe a sentence, what's your definition of mindfulness? And I'll tell you mine.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I call it two words: situational awareness. Ooh. Right. Yeah. Like everybody talks about situational awareness, battlefield awareness. That's mindfulness, man. It's being here in the present moment, paying attention to what's going on around you.
Absolutely. That's what I was going to say, living in the moment.
Yeah.
That's really that's the cornerstone of mindfulness. I mean, a lot of people think it's flowing robes and, you know, legs crossed and that's, it could be part of it.
Could be a part of it. Yeah.
But you're exactly right. Living in the moment. And it took me a while to get there. But the one thing I learned when I started doing mindfulness in meditation is not only living in the moment with, you know, feeling everything around me, the seat I'm on, everything, and, you know, smelling and, you know, using all my senses.
Yeah.
And then taking responsibility for whatever problems I have in my life, because I played a role in them. But
that's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah, and because it's worked for me. Now it took me a long time to get there.
Yeah,
but I think, and I love what you said about empathy and compassion, because I agree with you 150%. But I also think, and what do you think about, I mean, you have to love yourself first. I mean, you have to be compassionate to yourself. You got to be empathetic towards yourself, because I think the hardest battles, just in my opinion, we're ever going to face are with ourselves in our head.
100%, man. And that is another thing that I speak about on stage. When I speak about compassion, I tell this story, right? Remember Jennifer Lawrence, when she went up to receive her Oscar and she fell, right? She trips and everybody kind of mocked her and, you know, whether or not that particular event was staged for publicity, I always have my audience envision themselves at the pinnacle of their career and they're going before the world to be recognized for this achievement. And as they're going up, they fall down. And what words, what stories, what narratives are rolling through their heads when they envision this? And normally I get something from the audience like, idiot, fool, I knew this would happen. I'm never going to recover from this. I'm so embarrassed. I'm so stupid. Things like that.
Yeah.
And then I have them flip the script and envision that somebody that they love, a friend, or even someone for whom they have neutral feelings, and what things are being said in their mind. And it's like, hey, it's okay, buddy. You're going to be okay. Nobody saw that. You're going to recover from this. And that's to demonstrate that quite often we have more compassion for a complete stranger for whom we have neutral feelings than we do for ourselves. And I believe that in order to increase compassion for others, we have to increase compassion for ourselves. And the way that we do that is we realize that we're all wearing some level of armor or some mask. Like you and I here, it's two of us, but I guarantee even with the two of us speaking, there's some mask that the two of us are wearing, some level of armor. And, you know, when we're with our family, we wear a different mask, different set of armor. And then when we are by ourselves and nobody else is around, we get an opportunity to take that mask off, take that armor off. And what battles are we fighting when we are by ourselves? That's when we notice some of the battles, because now the armor is off us and we see the scars, we see the pain. And we're like, okay, I'm fighting a battle. Okay. If I know that about myself, then I know that about everybody else.
Yeah.
I know you're fighting a battle. I don't know what it is, but I guarantee because you're a human being, you're fighting some type of battle. And when you can start to have that compassion for yourself and understand the battles that you personally are fighting, then you can start to have compassion or more compassion for those around you. But it all starts with compassion and love for yourself, 100%.
Absolutely. And I think the reason, like I was pushing things down, I was afraid to take off my mask, like you said.
Yeah.
When I was a cop, and to some degree when I was in the military, it's because of fear. And ego was a big thing for me when I was struggling. It was, what are people going to think about me? You know, what are people going to say about me? I mean, I was, you know, I climbed the ranks as a cop, retired as a commander. And then all my problems started to happen after I retired because I lost my identity. I went through that period. And I was struggling. I was drinking. I was depressed. But I was so scared to reach out. And it was funny. I thought I was doing, you know, I thought I put the wool over my family's. They knew exactly what the hell was going on with me.
Yeah.
I was withering away, not only mentally, physically, but I was so afraid, John, of reaching out because I didn't want to be judged. But that, once I got past that fear and ego and got to the point where I really don't care what people think, I'm doing this for me and me only, I started to heal and I started to get better because I got not, but I think a lot of people struggle with that, especially military people.
Yeah. And I would even take it further. I think that especially military men, I mean, don't get me wrong there. I understand that there are plenty of military women who are struggling. I understand that there's struggles on both sides, but I think just across the masculine energy and the military is a hyper-masculine space. It's kind of frowned upon or seen as a weakness to ask for help. When in fact, think about how hard it is to ask for help. It's freaking hard.
Yeah, it is very hard.
And so in my mind, asking for help is a demonstration of strength.
Absolutely.
Far more than hiding it and covering it up and trying to deal with it on your own. That's weakness to me.
Yeah.
Not weakness. I don't want to say weakness because I know some people are out there listening and they're struggling and they're keeping it to themselves, but it is definitely more of a strength, a sign of strength to reach out and get help. And I encourage everybody to tap into that strength because no man, and I use that term as a gender neutral term, no man is an island, right? We all need help.
Yeah, at some point we do. I take it a step further. I think we all need a therapist at some point in our life.
100%.
We all need counselors.
I went to my counselor earlier today. Yeah. So I fully encourage talk counseling, having a therapist. I think, you know, that goes hand in hand with mindfulness and meditation. Just because I'm a mindfulness and meditation teacher and practitioner doesn't mean I've got all my stuff figured out.
Well, everybody's a work in progress.
Yes, we are.
You know, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. One of the things I heard that really resonated with me was on a show, it was on a podcast a while ago, but I remember it was Rogan show. And I think he had a former SEAL on there or somebody in the military, but what he said really resonates with me every day. He said, they were talking about the afterlife, heaven and hell. And Rogan asked his guest, he said, what do you think, what's your definition of hell? And he said, my definition of hell is passing away and meeting the person I could have been.
Yep. Yeah, I heard that before.
Did you hear that before?
Yeah, I didn't hear it on that episode, but I've heard that before.
Oh my God, that is so powerful. And how does it tie back into meditation? And just what we're talking about, John and I, is being your best self, tackling those things that you're afraid of, because that's where your growth is, right?
That's right, man. Yeah, you dodge the obstacles, you dodge the challenges, and you dodge the adversity. You're going to come up against other challenges, other obstacles, and other adversity that may be harder. I've got a buddy that says, choose your hard. You know, you actually are actively involved in your hard, or hard's going to come and get you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now I've heard, and maybe you can confirm this, John. I mean, I've heard like elite teams like the SEALs and maybe Delta CAG and other, you know, groups in the military, they're starting to adopt more and more mindfulness and meditation and yoga. Yeah. And is that true? Cause I know like professional sports teams do it. You know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It works.
It does, man. It has been adopted. I know at Navy boot camp, one of my buddies helped to bring the Navy warrior toughness program together. He's a SEAL master chief. And he jokes that the whole program was created by himself, a Navy SEAL master chief, a counselor, and a Navy chaplain. He's like, well, what happens when these three go into a bar together? They create the Navy Warrior Toughness Program. And that includes mindfulness and meditation in it to handle stress, to handle anxiety. But over and above that, it also makes you more present in your job, more focused, more productive. I think you show up differently as an individual, as a member of a team. You're more empathetic, you're more creative. There's just so many benefits of practicing. So definitely a lot of the high performing teams, SEALs, special forces are starting to bring some level of mindfulness and meditation in. Now, the ironic piece is I actually learned breath work before I ever was introduced to mindfulness and meditation. And I learned breath work on the shooting range, you know, doing some box breathing so that I could shoot better, so that I could shoot between heartbeats or in between breaths. Never called it meditation, never called it mindfulness, but I learned it in the teams, man. It's funny.
And that's what it is. And a lot of people who are familiar with firearms, I mean, you know, a lot of it's breathing, obviously, in other fundamentals, but yeah, breathing is central to it.
Yeah, it is, man.
Now, if somebody's listening, John, and they're, you know, maybe they're out
hopefully
of the country.
Somebody's listening.
Well, I didn't mean it that way. If somebody, nobody's listening right now. So no, but if somebody's listening to this and they are, you know, maybe they're getting ready to get deployed somewhere, and maybe they're not, you know, not necessarily a team guy, but a team guy or anybody else in the military or any person that has a stressful job.
Yeah.
What do you tell people like that come up to you and say, yeah, I have a stressful job, I've been multiple deployments or my first deployment. How do I find time?
Yeah.
Being, you know, especially in the teams, that operational tempo is go, 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 go.
Yeah.
How do you find time in the day to, okay, just do some meditation, do some mindfulness?
Well, quite often when I speak to organizations, I hold up my phone. I say, you know, who wakes up with their cell phone as far as like using that as an alarm clock? And 95% of the hands go up.
Exactly.
I'm like, okay, so when it goes off, aside from hitting snooze a couple times, what's the next thing you do? Everybody's like, I start scrolling through social media, email, look at my bank accounts, da, da, da. I'm like, okay. And how long do you do that? 30, 45 minutes. I'm like, okay, so you've been on your phone for 30 to 45 minutes before you've even gotten
looking at cat videos.
Yeah, right, right. Or the junk email that came in through the night.
Exactly.
Most of it's junk.
Yeah.
So I encourage them to do a time audit and see if they can find time.
When really
what I'm saying is I need you to reallocate some time, not find it. It's there. You've already found it. You're just wasting it. So that's one piece. But to the people who are truly like from when they wake up until when they go to bed, just going, 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 I encourage them to incorporate mindfulness, not necessarily meditation. If they can't do a meditation, if they can't sit down for 15, even 10 minutes to do a meditation, I just encourage them to do some type of mindfulness. And that maybe that's sitting down for lunch without your computer on, without your phone in your hand. You sit down, you pay attention to the colors, the shapes, the textures, the smells of the food on your plate, and then you express some gratitude. And I'm not necessarily meaning a prayer. If a prayer is your thing, that's more power to you. But expressing some type of gratitude for that food on your plate, that's a mindfulness activity.
Yeah.
And then maybe when you're driving to or from work, the last minute that you're in the car, turn the radio off. Tune into the sound of the wheels rolling on the road, the tactile sensation of the steering wheel in your hand and the seat against your butt and back. That's a mindfulness practice. Yeah. And as you start to tune in to those little things, a lot of the same benefits, if you do that over and over and over, a lot of the same benefits come from that than come from meditation.
Yeah, I love it. And you're exactly right. I mean, we fill our day. And again, I'm not trying to discount people who are very busy. You are, I am. But okay, what are you spending time with? I mean, like you gave a great example, 30 minutes on the phone. I've gotten to a point, and I've incorporated this a couple of years ago, whereas I don't even have the phone next to me.
Yeah, me neither, man.
I have it on the other side of the room.
Yeah, I have my phone in my kitchen. That's where I charge it over the night.
And I keep it on the other side of the room. So I'm not tempted before I go to bed, because you probably know, you know, reading and all the lights and stuff and is not good for your brain.
Yeah.
But I love what you said about gratitude, because one of the first thing I do in the morning, John, is I just sit in bed for just a couple minutes and I go through a gratitude practice of, and for those listening out there, it doesn't have to be elaborate, but if you want it to be elaborate, make it to be elaborate. But first of all, I'm glad I'm alive. Second of all, I'm glad I'm, you know, I have food in my fridge. I'm glad I have a home over my head. And you would be surprised. I know you know this, but for the listener, if you start doing that, that kind of sets the tone for the rest of the day.
Sure does,
you
man.
Know, because if you wake up pissed and you wake up, you check an email that triggers you or sets you off, that's probably going to be the tone of your day.
Yep. I had a conversation with a guy this morning, and in the conversation, we came up with a new term, and it's called emotional hygiene. And emotional hygiene, if you can imagine, we have our sleep hygiene, we have our physical hygiene, right? We shower to wash dirt off our bodies. We brush our teeth to get rid of all the green germs on our teeth. That's hygiene. Yeah. Well, emotional hygiene is washing off the emotions from the day before or the event before, whatever the case is. If you're carrying all those emotions into the next event of your day, you're going to show up with those emotions changing who you truly are. But if you can take a pause in between events, I mean, even Zoom calls, right? Zoom is like what most people live on these days, is some type of Zoom call. I mean, here we are on one right now. But, and I'm not knocking Zoom, but so many people live on Zoom all day, back to back to back, and they find that they're, you know, before they know it, they've been on six Zoom calls, six 1 hour long Zoom calls, and they haven't even gotten up to go to the bathroom. And they're not rinsing off whatever it is they had from one Zoom call to the next, and they never get to emotionally reset, mentally reset. So emotional hygiene is our new term.
I love that. And you know, I mean, you know, this listeners know that we live in a very, you know, information's getting bombarded to us every second of the day between the news and all this social media and stuff. But stepping back, like you said, and taking time to just breathe and just kind of live in the moment. And the stuff that you are stressing out about that you have to do immediately, it'll be still be there if you take 5-10 minutes. The world's not going to end if you take 5 or 10 minutes to take care of yourself a little better.
Are we going to be better? The world would be a better place, right?
Exactly, man. I mean, it took me a long time to get to this place, John, and I imagine it probably did for you too.
It
takes a practice. So, but when we live in, and I think that's the problem too, is my opinion, we live in an instant gratification world where, you know, and you probably heard this a lot. Well, I tried meditation, didn't work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Well, you have to build up to it.
Right. Yeah.
Well, my mind's racing all the time. Okay. Your mind is used to that. You have to train your mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you don't have to start out with an hour.
No, man. And even like the in-depth meditations that are 5 minutes, don't start with that. Start just sitting. Just sit for 5 minutes without moving. That in and of itself is a mindfulness practice. And that takes different discipline. Like some people, when I run retreats and the first thing I do is just have them sit still for 5 minutes. Some people struggle with that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people. So, hey, and that's not a bad thing. It's just the society that we live in, this going. And we need to have time in our day to do nothing more often, literally reset our brain.
Absolutely. I have a buddy who every year, he's pretty successful, and every year he takes a digital detox for a week.
Wow. Nice.
And he goes out, of course he's wealthy, but he gives his, but I love the idea. I mean, you know, he's very successful, but he tells his assistant, okay, I'm going to this place, book it for me. Here's my phone. Obviously she knows the details of God forbid. She does need to get in touch with him. But then when he goes to wherever, Costa Rica, he lands and he actually has to figure stuff out without a cell phone.
I did.
And so he doesn't have that distraction anymore. Yep. And I'm not advocating for that, because most of us are, you know, and maybe that's a good idea. I mean, I've tried it a couple times now for a week.
Yeah.
But he spends much more time with himself.
Dude, I did it for 56 hours from Friday afternoon until Monday morning, 3 weeks ago. And man, I was so much more present with my kids, absolutely, so much more present with my wife. And my wife was like, you know what? You need to do this every weekend.
The flip side is when you turn on your phone, John, you have 2,000 emails.
I was overloaded, but luckily I planned on that. So I didn't wake up in the morning on Monday morning in my bed and check it all.
What did we do before cell phones? I can't remember. The kids actually went MapQuest outside and
to print up directions on MapQuest.
I remember the actual map. You remember? I mean, you go on a trip and you have to, the Atlas, Rand McNall or whatever.
Yeah, Rand McNally.
my dad would say, all right, where are we going? I'd be like, hey, okay, we got to go here and here.
Yeah, you got to buy a new one every year.
In the world of business, we still have time to spend time with ourselves and obviously absolutely, the ones we love and engage and do this mindfulness and meditation. So, John, if anybody wants to reach out to you, brother, how can they find you? You're amazing. You know that. And maybe hire you or bring you on to talk to their organization. How can they find you, brother?
Well, thanks, brother. I appreciate the opportunity. I've gone from having and just putting out all my different social medias on these podcasts to, hey, if you just text the word mindful to the number 33777, that'll take you to my Linktree, which has all the things that I'm involved in. So.
You're international, man. Any final thought before we sign off, my friend?
No, brother. I just want to say thanks again for the opportunity. And I love this show. It's always fun. So maybe I'll come on a third time, man.
Yeah. Or maybe you come down to Florida, man. You can
there we go. Down here. Do it in person.
All right, brother.
All right.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.